The fourth and final matter on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Eau Claire. Council, as you are getting situated, I will remind you of our rules. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel. If you'd like to use it for rebuttal, I'll just go ahead and relax. You can be seated. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of who's making the arguments in our audio recording, which is available to the public. There is a button or switch at the front of the lectern which allows you to raise or lower the platform to your convenience. And there's no rush, but whenever you're ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you may.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sarah Gadd, and I represent the appellant, Hurry Tyrone Beauclair. And this case revolves around whether or not the district court erred in making the determination that a Terry frisk that occurred on the morning of December 16th of 2021 on the appellant, Mr. Beauclair, was constitutional. The district court found that the frisk was constitutional on grounds that it was supported by an articulable suspicion that Mr. Beauclair was armed and dangerous and engaged in criminal activity. However, the district court made numerous errors in making the determination that Mr. Beauclair was armed and dangerous and engaged in criminal activity. The court relied on 7 pieces of stipulated evidence submitted by the state, and that consists of 3 different body-worn camera footages from 3 different officers, plus a transcript of one of the officers' body-worn camera footage, plus the Minneapolis police report that was written up about the incident, and a transcript of the arresting officer's testimony at a Rasmussen hearing.
Was the 911 recording included in the submissions for the suppression motion?
I don't believe so. There was no...
There was testimony, though, as to what was said about the driver being unconscious or asleep.
It was in the police report. There's the dispatch note that said there's a 911 caller reported that a green sedan had crashed into a light pole and the driver appeared to be either unconscious or asleep.
So let's, on the first issue that you raised, which is... on the question of the encounter, which is whether a law was under investigation, we don't have to rely just on what the officers represent as the potential basis for an investigation. We can look at whether there's other possible crimes that could have been under investigation, right?
Correct. And
the court focuses on, and the parties seem to focus on drunk driving, but. Are you familiar with it? Nobody cites it, but the Al Nasir case is kind of a regularly cited case for other propositions. But the Supreme Court there, I'll just read to you. In the context of careless driving, carelessness is synonymous with ordinary negligence. And the court goes on to talk about the what's necessary for careless driving versus the higher level of carelessness necessary for the issue that was involved in that case, which involved a homicide. But Minnesota statutes prohibit careless driving. There's a report that your client was either unconscious or asleep at the wheel, resulting in a collision with a pole.
Correct.
Why isn't that enough for an officer to investigate the offense of careless driving?
Well, because in one case, State versus Carver, the Minnesota Court of Appeals held that a crash alone is not enough to jump to the conclusion that somebody was impaired. And I would note that
I'm talking about impairment. I'm talking about a witness who says the driver who had this collision at a low speed appeared to be either asleep or unconscious. So not impaired driving, but being asleep while driving could constitute, according to the Supreme Court, could constitute the crime of careless driving. So in light of that, first, do you disagree with that? And if you agree with that, why isn't that enough of a basis to justify an investigation by the officers for the not drunk driving, but careless driving?
There's nothing in the record to suggest that the two law enforcement officers who were dispatched to the scene who conducted the Terry frisk were aware of the statement that the 911 caller made. They were dispatched to the scene and...
corporate knowledge? Isn't there case law that says if law enforcement is informed, then all of law enforcement essentially has that knowledge?
But at the time that they were approaching the scene and conducting the frisk, they were not investigating Mr. Beauclair for any sort of traffic offense.
No, I know they weren't. The question, though, on appeal is whether there was a basis for that investigation, correct?
I would argue in this case, no.
No, I mean, isn't that the legal question? Is there a basis for law enforcement? Is there a crime that the officers could have been investigating based upon the circumstances, which in this case include a report of a person asleep or unconscious and having a collision at a slow speed?
Be that as it may, the dispositive issue in this case was the constitutionality of the Terry frisk. In going through the different items of stipulated evidence, the officer who conducted the Terry frisk, it appears to be some ex post facto justifications stating in the police report, which was submitted as stipulated evidence and Mr. Beauclair stipulated facts trial, that Officer Nick...
offered as evidence at the suppression hearing. Isn't that the record that we... the scope of our review, the record submitted in connection with the suppression hearing?
Yeah, and the testimony at the suppression hearing, however, conflicts with the officer's write-up of what happened during the incident, also conflicts with the body-worn camera footage. So the district court found on four separate bases that Mr. Beauclair was armed and dangerous and engaged in criminal activity to the extent that it was necessary to conduct a Terry frisk. First, that when the officers approached, his hands were in his pockets, but I would note that the medics that he was standing next to were also standing with their hands in their pockets, ostensibly because this happened in the middle of December. And so while, with the incriminating emphasis placed on the fact that Mr. Beauclair had his hands in his pockets, this court has directed that there be... that the officer looked to potential innocent explanations for suspicious activity. And in this instance, there's a very plausible explanation again. Mr. Beauclair was not wearing gloves and was standing outside in the middle of winter. And to be sure, both of the medics that he was standing next to when the officers approached, and I would also note that Mr. Beauclair and the medics were casually bantering and laughing when the officers approached. There was nothing objectively suspicious about his demeanor.
But what about Officer David's testimony that he saw what he believed to be a knife hanging from or coming out of your client's pocket?
Yes.
Why isn't that enough to create reasonable, articulable suspicion that your client was armed?
Because the knife that Mr. Beauclair had inside of his right jeans pocket was not discovered until 68 seconds into the search incident to arrest, and it was not even discovered by Officer Davids. It was discovered by Officer Oppegard of the Minneapolis Police Department, and the body-worn camera footage from him was also submitted into evidence.
Was there testimony that the knife was observed before the search?
So in the police report, Officer David said, I walked up to Mr. Beauclair and immediately saw a knife in his right pocket. However, the district court actually notes in the order denying the motion to suppress that the pocket knife was not visible. It only became visible when Mr. Beauclair shrugged his shoulders and responded to the question of what happened regarding...
Okay, so let's assume that's so. So the knife becomes visible before any search.
No, that was his belt that became visible. When he shrugged his shoulders, the district court wrote in the order denying the motion to suppress that a pocket knife was observed when Mr. Beauclair shrugged his shoulders, at which point his windbreaker lifted up.
Right.
There was nothing visible.
So there was nothing unconstitutional about unconstitutional about asking him to remove his hands from his pockets or asking what happened, leading him to shrug.
Right, but it's a little bit confusing because the sequence of events differs between the written report that was submitted into the stipulated facts trial, as well as the testimony, as well as what you actually observe on the body-worn camera footage. So what actually happened in the body-worn camera footage is when the officers approach, Mr. Beauclair was standing next to the medics, and there is a third medic in the process of reversing his car from the curb to the street, ostensibly for him to drive home, and then Officer Moore walks up and says, "What happened, man?" To which he replied, "I don't know, but I haven't been on no drugs or nothing." And at that point, Officer Moore, who posed the question, looked away, and Officer Davids ordered Mr. Beauclair to put his hands up. And in the written report, Officer Davids states that he told Mr. Beauclair, "I need to search you for weapons for my safety and the medic's safety and your safety." But if you watch the body-worn camera footage, that did not happen. But that would suggest...
It seems like you're inviting us to reweigh the district court's credibility determinations. I mean, especially when, as you're suggesting, the evidence is conflicting. I mean, that is uniquely the district court's role to make fact findings based on conflicting and evidence that you assert was not credible.
Well, the totality of the evidence does not support a finding that Mr. Beauclair was armed, dangerous, and engaged in criminal activity. There was absolutely nothing suspicious about his demeanor, and the officer testified to this during the arrest.
Can I stop you there for a second? Would you agree that if the officer saw a knife, that would be sufficient basis for the officer then to say, "Yeah, I'm going to pat you down for weapons"?
If the officer saw the knife before he patted him down for weapons.
Okay, so are you saying that the district court's finding precludes that the officer saw the knife before patting him down for weapons?
The officer testified that he didn't testify that he saw the knife immediately as he walked up.
I understand that. He testified, though, that he saw the knife. At some, whatever time the officer says he saw the knife was before the pat down.
It was not. The knife was not discovered until 68 seconds into the search by Officer Oppegard.
I thought that you said that the officer testified that he saw the knife before the pat-down.
No, he wrote in the police report that he saw the knife, and that's why he told Mr. Beauclair that he needed to search him for weapons. But then during his testimony, he says that he asked to search Mr. Beauclair because Mr. Beauclair denied that the accident was drug-related. He goes so far as to say that as soon as he approached Mr. Beauclair immediately and just defensively put his hands up.
Was there any testimony about the timing of the seeing the knife for the first time?
Yes. So he actually... Yeah, so he says, "As you approached him, did you observe any weapons?" "I saw a knife." "Okay, and where was this?" I believe it was in his right pocket. So on seeing the knife and being that it was a possible DWI investigation or medical type issues, I was going to check for further weapons.
So the testimony is that the knife was visible to the officers before the pat search.
In the testimony, yes.
So given that testimony, would you have... Do you concede as a matter of law that an officer who observes a knife under the circumstances of this case would have enough minimal reasonable suspicion to conduct a pat down for weapons?
Not in this case, no.
Why not?
Because it is almost unequivocal that the discovery of the pocket knife occurred during the search incident to arrest.
Maybe I'm not being clear. In light of the testimony that the officer saw the knife before the pat-down search, assuming the district court credited the officer's testimony that the officer saw the knife before the pat-down search, would you concede that seeing the knife before the pat-down search would be enough to justify a reasonable suspicion pat search for weapons?
If that were truly the sequence of events that occurred, but the district court even noted in the order denying the motion to suppress that the when he shrugged his shoulders, at that point something became visible hanging from his belt, from his waistband, and that wasn't actually the pocket knife, that was his belt. The pocket knife was affixed inside of the right pocket of his jeans. And
district court found that the officer saw a belt buckle, not a knife?
No, the district court said that.
So you're arguing that the district court's findings are clearly erroneous. Is that essentially what you're arguing?
No, not necessarily, just with the pocket knife, but
the finding about the pocket knife is clearly erroneous?
In light of the body-worn camera footage, yes. There was no knife that was visible when the officers approached. And this is clear on the body cam footage. You see Mr. Beauclair being approached by an officer. He's wearing a windbreaker that's almost down to his knees. He's standing there with his hands in his pocket and his gaze averted to the ground. And when the medics were briefing the officers on what happened, and Mr. Beauclair was waiting for his car to be returned to him, Officer Moore, who was the one who found the firearm but did not instigate the search, just asked what happened, and Mr. Beauclair said, "I don't know, but I haven't been on no drugs or nothing." And the district court found that the unexplained car accident coupled with that unprompted statement created reasonable suspicion that he was driving while intoxicated, but there was no other indications that he was intoxicated. Nobody reported that he was intoxicated. He wasn't behaving as though he were intoxicated.
I thought you agreed, though, that there would be enough, if the Al-Nasir court is correct about careless driving, that would be a separate basis, not discussed by the district court, for the officers to investigate your client and the circumstances of the collision.
I think that it's a totality of the circumstances assessment, and I don't believe that there was anything objectively suspicious that would indicate that Mr. Beauclair was a threat to the safety of the officers or anybody else around him, given the totality of the circumstances. He was standing there politely with the medics. They were smiling and bantering. And as soon as the officers approached, as soon as he was ordered to put his hands up, he did. And the officer changes the justifications for why he decided to search him. And so I guess if somebody being frisked and arrested, you know, on erroneous grounds, if the conviction can be sustained because they possibly could have been investigated for another crime.
I think that's the law, isn't it? That there's two separate issues. One, do the officers have a basis under the law to detain your client, which would be the investigation of a crime, which could either be drunk driving or careless driving. That's a separate question from whether the officers then had reasonable suspicion to pat down your client on the possibility of having a dangerous weapon.
But in Carver, this court held that an accident alone is not enough to justify a temporary pat-down or a Terry frisk. A car accident alone is not enough to jump to the conclusion that somebody was impaired and therefore that there's probable cause to believe that that person was driving while intoxicated.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal
okay.
time as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dakota Lemuel, certified student attorney, along with my supervising attorney, Nicole Cornell. Together, we represent the state of Minnesota. Today, we're asking this court to affirm the trial court's denial of appellant's motion to suppress. And we're also asking this court to reject appellant's claim for ineffective assistance of counsel. With my time today, I'd like to address three things. First, I'd like to address how the district court correctly determined that officers had reasonable suspicion that appellant was involved or may have been involved in criminal activity. Then I'd like to address how the district court correctly determined that the officers had reasonable suspicion that appellant may have been armed and dangerous. And then with my remaining time, I'd like to address any of the court's questions about appellant's claim for ineffective assistance of counsel. The district court got this right. Officers were justified in conducting a pat frisk of appellant after he crashed into a pole at 6:30 in the morning, which is a bizarre collision. And then after that, officers were correct when they observed him stumbling around.
Does the record before us on appeal include the police report which references the 911 call?
No, it does not. Officers were also correct in determining or thinking that concluding that appellant may have been involved in some criminal activity when he volunteered that he didn't do drugs or anything. These circumstances were the reasons why the district court found that appellant may have been involved in a criminal activity. The Seminole Terry case requires that an officer suspect two things before a pat frisk can be conducted. The first is that the individual be believed to be involved in some criminal activity, and next, that the individual be armed and dangerous.
What were the circumstances in Terry that the Supreme Court relied upon to justify the pat search?
Yes, Your Honor. The officer in Terry observed the individuals engaging in behavior that was consistent with casing a store. Based on the officer's experience and training, he believed that usually individuals who are casing a store, they have weapons with them. And so that is what tied the two.
Right, because the officer suspected that if they were casing the store, they may be, to use the words of the time, involved in a potential stick-up or hold-up involving weapons. And I think that's what the Supreme Court relied upon, isn't it?
That's correct,
to say that there's reasonable suspicion to pat down for weapons. Well, what is there in Mr. Beauclair's, the investigation of Mr. Beauclair's underlying potential crime that would suggest possession of a firearm?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the officers immediately suspected that he had a firearm. Officer Davids testifies on page 8 of the transcript. He says that when he received the call, there were two things that popped in his mind. First is that the person may be experiencing a medical emergency, and next that they are driving under the influence.
Right, neither of which, unlike Terry, are circumstances that would automatically lead one to suspect that a firearm might also be present.
That's correct.
So you need more.
That's correct. You do need more.
So what was there in this case that would lead the officers to reasonably suspect that Mr. Beauclair had a firearm on his or any other dangerous weapon?
Well, as Officer Davids testified, he observed the knife as he was approaching appellant. I know that counsel mentioned that that's not correct, but Officer Davids consistently testified that he saw the knife as he was approaching appellant. He may not have audibly said it, and even in appellant's addendum, there is a snapshot, and there
yet
is an
object.
He
stood next to him without any apparent concern until the other if he saw the knife as he's approaching.
Yes.
I believe the argument is that if there was a finding that the knife was visible before the pat search, it was clearly erroneous. And we can make that determination, I think the argument goes, based upon the body cam footage. What's wrong with that argument, if anything?
Well, Your Honor, that is inconsistent with the record. The knife is seen in the video. The district court also notes that. And I think that this was a very short encounter.
But if the district court recognizes and says that, well, the knife is visible once the shoulders are shrugged and the jacket goes up, and the body cam footage of the officer doesn't make it apparent to us that it's visible, is that enough for us to say that the district court's finding is clearly erroneous, that the officer saw the knife before the pat search? If not, why not?
No, because of the officer, based on the officer's testimony. The officer testified consistently that the knife was observed prior to the pat frisk was ever conducted.
But don't we see what the officer saw when we have the body cam footage?
To an extent, yes.
Do we see a knife?
We see an object hanging from appellant's pants pocket, yes, as he's approaching. And then moments later, the concern that the officer may have had for any medical emergency was diminished when the emergency medical personnel tells the officer that appellant is saying he's fine and he's rejecting medical treatment. So combined, in totality, we have a bizarre car collision, we have a knife hanging from appellant's pocket, and then we have the unprompted statement that he didn't do drugs. So the officers then, based on their training and experience and what they personally observed, they determined that a pat frisk was appropriate to ensure their safety and the safety of the emergency medical personnel.
Does it matter whether the object, Officer Davids, testified that he saw, whether it was actually a knife or whether he reasonably believed it was a knife?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't matter. And that's just because in State versus Lehmert, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the officer doesn't have to be absolutely certain that the individual is carrying a weapon. The standard is that that a person that's in the same circumstances would reasonably infer the same thing.
So what is it about these circumstances that would lead the officer to believe they were in danger, that there was a weapon that they would face if they didn't search?
Yes, Your Honor. So in considering everything in totality, the officers reasonably concluded that they might be in danger based on the view of the knife, appellant's bizarre statement, and also the nature of the collision.
What is the bizarre statement? How does that pose a threat to them? When you say bizarre, it's an exculpatory statement.
Well, the statement is
no drugs are involved. Well, how is that? Does that statement suggest a danger to the officers?
My apologies, Your Honor. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're fine.
The statement doesn't suggest, on its own, doesn't suggest that appellant is armed and dangerous, but in the totality of circumstances, it does suggest some criminal activity, and it is a statement that is out of place.
But okay, out of place and criminal activity, but not criminal activity of firearm, and not out of place in the sense that my life is in danger if I don't pat search him. I'm trying to get the sense of how this statement, I'm not on any drugs, would lead the officer, I don't know, how is that probative in the officer's mind on the question of whether or not there's a dangerous weapon on Mr. Beauclair's property or in person?
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to respond to that in two parts, if I may. The first is that Mr. Beauclair's statement that he didn't do drugs or anything, Officer Davids testified that that statement was more so suggestive that he may have been on some kind of substance when the car collision happened. So it was not necessarily tied to the idea that he may have been armed and dangerous, but it was tied to him being involved in criminal activity.
Okay, so let's assume that the officers had a basis to investigate either drunk driving, careless driving, or whatever. Now we have to get to the next step. The officers have to have reasonable suspicion that the individual is armed. You've acknowledged that in Terry, you had underlying facts because of the crime that was being investigated would imply the possession of a firearm. You don't have that for either of the crimes that might be investigated in this case. So what additional facts were available to the officers that would cause them to believe that they needed to pat Mr. Beauclair down for weapons?
In addition to seeing the knife, which is a weapon, officers also noted that appellant kept his hands in his pockets while he was talking to them, kind of close to his body.
On December 16th?
Yes, Your Honor. And
without gloves?
Yes, that's correct. And although the officers could possibly attribute
that
to
some. And they said, remove your hands from your pockets, and he took his hands out of his pockets.
He did. But
so at that point, there's no longer a danger about what's in his pocket, is there?
No, that concern is not eliminated when he takes his hands out of his pockets, because that would be the case maybe if everything else that preceded that didn't happen. So we still, again, under Martinson, everything's supposed to be considered in totality. So we still have the unexplained collision at 6:30 in the morning. We still have the knife that's hanging from his pockets. We still have the unprompted statement.
The knife is now hanging from his pocket?
It's clipped to his right pants pocket. In State versus Kaveen, the Minnesota Supreme Court upheld the officer's pat frisk for similar reasons. The individual or the defendant in that case was giving unprompted statements. He kept his hands in his pockets while he's speaking with law enforcement and kind of holding something close to his body. And the court found that the officer was justified in conducting a pat frisk there. And additionally, in State versus Kaveen, the court noted, or the officer also noted, the individual's nervousness. Now, I know that appellant's counsel has characterized his statement as just something that he just said. It didn't really mean anything. But at a minimum, it could be classified as nervousness, as nervousness. And so I think those things in totality would give officers a reason to believe.
Take me through that logic. How does a statement, I'm not on any drugs, how does that lead to the officer? First of all, the officer didn't testify that the officer perceived that as a sign of nerves.
That's correct. He did not.
So why would we jump to that? And well, the district court didn't find that either. So well, why would we as an appellate court jump to that finding?
Well, appellant's counsel has kind of characterized or repeatedly stated that prior to being confronted by law enforcement, appellant's demeanor was calm and he was laughing and joking with the emergency medical personnel. And then as soon as officers arrive and they start speaking with him, it's apparent from the body-worn camera that his demeanor does change and that he does volunteer that he didn't do drugs or anything. So at a minimum, that would...
His demeanor changed?
Yes. The nervousness, the unprompted statement, even if the statement wasn't him speaking truth, it would certainly... Because it was so bizarre and he kind of volunteered it, an officer would find that suspicious and probably attribute it to nervousness.
But not tell the court that when the officer was under oath?
He wasn't asked that question. But it is clear from the body-worn camera, Your Honor. Next, I'd like to address the officer's suspicion that appellant was armed and dangerous. As I mentioned before, a lot of the argument centers around the unprompted statement that appellant was, that he didn't do drugs or anything. But even without that statement, there is a visible weapon on appellant. In Terry versus Ohio, there was no weapons, there were no furtive movements, and similarly...
Well, be careful. Terry versus Ohio was based upon the assumption that individuals who are under suspicion for a holdup would be using a gun in the holdup.
That's correct, Your Honor, but what I'm trying to distinguish here is that in this case, we have a visible weapon. A knife is a visible weapon. So appellant's argument is that he didn't make furtive movements and he wasn't being aggressive. And the 911 call, which was discussed during the Rasmussen hearing, in that hearing, the officer testified that he did not receive any kind of call that appellant may have been acting violently, but that is not what is required. So what I'm trying to distinguish here is that in this case, the officers were justified in conducting the pat frisk because there was a visible weapon hanging from appellant's person. My time is running short, but the district court did not err by denying appellant's motion to suppress. Appellant did not receive an effective assistance of counsel, and this court should affirm his conviction for ineligible possession of a firearm. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
I would note that the Minneapolis police report was submitted into evidence as State Exhibit 1 to your question to Respondent's Counsel.
Including the report of the Does that include the basis for the call, the unconscious or the sleep?
It was the full 26-page report, yes. So the unprompted statement, I didn't do drugs, was not actually unprompted at all. When Officer Davids testified, he said that as soon as he approached, the first thing Mr. Beauclair did was put his hands up defensively and said, "Officer, I'm not on drugs." That is unequivocally false. The body-worn camera footage shows that Mr. Beauclair is asked by Officer Davids' squad partner, Ezra Moore, "What happened, man?" And Mr. Beauclair just shrugged his shoulders and said, "I don't know, but I haven't been on no drugs or nothing."
That's kind of a bizarre response, isn't it? I mean, it's not responsive to the question.
I mean, as a criminal defense attorney, I would say that that's indicative of somebody who's had prior dealings with law enforcement. And
suggest it's indicative of nervousness, as Respondent's Counsel suggested.
Possibly.
Or possibly concerned that the officer suspects that I was on drugs, and so I'm just going to avert that suspicion right off the bat. Not necessarily a sign of nervousness, you're saying.
The statement that Mr. Beauclair's demeanor changed when the officers approached is, I don't believe that that is actually true. Mr. Beauclair was standing with his hands in his pockets, and as soon as the officers approached, he just diverted his gaze to the ground, ostensibly because he was nervous. He had just gotten into a car accident and was being approached by law enforcement officers. But it still does not, it still begs the question of how does the statement, "I am not on drugs," combined with a single person car accident, evoke a suspicion that the police officer could not do his job safely without frisking Mr. Beauclair.
If all the officer saw was the knife and there was no other behavior other than the fact that there was a collision, the officers, forget about the statement about not being on drugs, would that be enough to justify the search? Officer sees a knife attached to the side of his pants.
I don't believe that alone would be sufficient. You have to take into account the totality of the circumstances. Did he make any furtive gestures towards his pants? Was he engaging or exhibiting any other suspicious behaviors? Was he being aggressive or loud, boisterous, or make any kind of threat or say anything?
Well, if the officer saw a gun instead of a knife, wouldn't that be a basis to pat search him?
Yes.
Why wouldn't a knife be enough? I mean, that's a dangerous weapon as well. I'll just quote from the Supreme Court's decision again, Terry versus Ohio. It must therefore be confined in the scope of an intrusion reasonably designed to discover guns, knives, clubs, or other hidden instruments for the assault of the police officer. So even in Terry versus Ohio, it wasn't just a concern about guns. The court was aware that there are other instruments that might cause harm to officers. The officer should be concerned about those, and that would include knives.
But under those circumstances, Mr. Beauclair was outnumbered by two armed police officers, and be that as it may, the totality of the circumstances in this case, just by even viewing the first 90 seconds of the body cam footage, does not show that Mr. Beauclair was armed and dangerous and engaged in criminal activity. If the statement that "I'm not on drugs today" combined with the single, you know, person accident engendered a suspicion that he might have been driving while impaired, then it begs the question of why was he not investigated for driving under the influence? Why was he not subjected to a field sobriety test or a breathalyzer? I mean, it's clear why, because Officer Davids did testify that there was nothing even remotely indicating that Mr. Beauclair was intoxicated at the time. And by his own admission, there was nothing suspicious about the way he was behaving, and he had no reason to suspect that there was a firearm in his pocket before he conducted the search. So We would ask that you reverse the district court's decision and remand the case for an order dismissing the charge on grounds that the Terry stop was in violation of Mr. Beauclair's Fourth Amendment rights to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gadd and Ms. Lemuel. Well done by both of you. Nice job. Is this your first time arguing before the Court of Appeals?
It's my second time.
Your second time. Oh, well, very nice. You both did a very great job. Thank you for your briefing. Interesting issue, kind of a hot bench, probably not fun for either one of you, but it's in the nature of things to get at the heart, and sometimes the record's not so clear, so I hope you appreciate we have to probe these things and find out what actually is going on. So thank you both for your argument. The matter is submitted. The issue is under advisement, and we will render our decision within the statutory period. Thank you both. Have a good afternoon. And that is... being the last case on our oral calendar today, the court is in recess.